British Spy Stories, Season 2, The Kill Order. Episode 11.
I'm going out for 20 minutes, Prof, says Carling. Don't go anywhere.
Morrison grunts in response and continues to read a Cambridge University paper. He listens for the noise of the street door closing behind Carling, then puts the paper aside, kneels down, and pulls out his suitcase from beneath the bed in his room. He opens it, checks the contents, then refastens the case. He takes his coat off the hook on the back of the door and makes his way down the stairs to the street. He waits for a moment, wondering how long Carling will take to disappear around the corner, then opens the door and peers out. A few people are walking on the pavements and two cars are making their way slowly along the street. But there's no sign of Carling. Morrison steps out and slams the door behind him and starts walking towards Copenhagen Station. The tiny cafe is nearly empty as the waitress puts the plate of pancakes down in front of Laravel. She didn't get a chance to eat much yesterday as she'd been called in to the British Embassy in Berlin for a debriefing on Windfall. They wanted to know what had happened at the site where the lorry was attacked, and what went wrong during the extraction. In the room had been the new MI6 Berlin station chief, Angela Crick, and Major Rogers from the SAS. Rogers had tried to imply that any errors were down to the spies and not his blades. Crick had been excellent in getting Rogers to take a more even-handed line, at first. But the session had ended with the conclusion that the planning had been insufficient before the op. And as the planning had been done by MI6 and SAS teams, neither side could blame the other for the injury to Coda. That conclusion seemed to please Crick and Rogers. But Laravel had been livid that there was even the implication of errors on her part. She had done everything asked of her, and to come out with some cover-up, so everyone could play happy bunnies, was the worst kind of compromise bullshit, she thought, but didn't say, before leaving the room. The meeting had finished at 11 p.m, and afterwards Laravel had gone to a bar on her own and drunk too many beers. A guy had started chatting to her, and they'd ended up going back to his flat and sleeping together. She'd left at 4 in the morning and got back to her place, then slept until midday. She didn't know the guy's name, and that's exactly what she wanted. Anonymity is good right now. She finishes the food and starts on bread rolls and tea that the waitress had added to the table. The door to the cafe opens, letting in a billow of freezing air, followed by Iwana and Teresa. They call to the waitress for drinks, pull out 2 wooden chairs at Laravel's table, and sit simultaneously.
They're not feeding you, says Iwana. A girl needs a nourishment, you know. Have you sorted out your plan for Babu? Says Teresa. Working on it. Ain't got much time. Why? He's not going to sit around waiting, is he?
Iwana's face is a field of anger.
I don't know. Well, take it from me, I know the fucker. Once he's got something into his head, he doesn't let go. He always wants everything, straight away. I'll sort it, says Laravel. An eye for an eye. You hurt my family, I hurt you.
The van from the British Embassy drops off a suitcase for Gabby as the day ends in the streets of Berlin. Inside the case is a complete set of clothing and papers for her cover life. She looks at the passport that comms branch have created for her and reads through the backstory that she'll use when she meets Babu. Erika Müller is a German national. She grew up in Berlin and went to the arts university in the city. Her parents both died when she was young, and she was brought up by her father's brother and his wife. She has no siblings. After university, she had struggled financially, and with no money and no job, she ended up on the fringes of prostitution. Then over the course of the next 2 years, she became a high-end escort, working at the large hotels in Berlin, with their never-ending supply of businessmen, staying away from home,
who welcomed her sophisticated company. By the time she was in her late 20s, Erica was running a number of cool girls herself, firstly in Berlin, then in other cities in Europe. Now, she wants to expand in Belgrade, and is a good friend of Ruslan Novik, a Belarusian spy and criminal who knows Babu and recommended that she visit Belgrade to discuss how she could work with the mafia's prostitution operation in the city. Gabby has met Novik half a dozen times, as he was turned by the British in the early 2000s, and is now a regular source of intelligence for London. Cover lives are one thing that MI6 does very well. Inside the case, there are not only clothes but photos of her fictional family, and even a letter from her aunt. She hauls the suitcase to street level and calls a cab that takes her to a deserted industrial street in the northeast of Berlin. She walks to a lonely part of an access road that has six garages on one side. Gabby pushes a key into the panel next to the last garage, and the door starts to rise. When it's fully up, she presses the BMW fob in her hand, and her Z4 flashes to show the doors are open. She gets in and fires up the engine. The sat-nav shows her route, down to Dresden, across to Czechia, and through Prague, then Bratislava, Budapest, and across into Serbia, near Szeged. Gabby noses out into the street and turns the car south, towards Belgrade. Ella walks up the steps at Green Park Underground Station and turns down into the grassland. She heads towards location Amber 5, a junction where five paths meet in the middle of the park. This meeting place has been used by MI5 since the 1950s, and Marjorie is already there, sitting on a bench reading the Times. Ella sits down. Marjorie folds the newspaper and turns to look at her. "How are you coping?" she says.
"Not well."
"In what way?"
"I'm not used to dealing with operations. Normally I'm just mining data and presenting it."
Marjorie explores the younger woman's face.
"When was the last time you saw Stefan?" "Friday. He stayed."
"And what have you told him?"
"Nothing."
"I can confirm a couple of things," says Marjorie. "He does work for the Moldovan Intelligence Service. And there is useful data that we think he might have, that we need."
"What information?"
"A list of Moldovan agents," says Marjorie. "In the EU and in Russia." Ella's brows knit together.
"Why Russia and not the UK?"
"That's just what I've been told," says Marjorie. "Maybe we already know the Moldovan agents here." Ella keeps her gaze on the other woman for a second. "It won't make the job any different, just a different list, that's all."
"And how do I get this information?"
says Ella. "We'll give you codes to get into his laptop." Ella has no expression. People walk past them along the five paths, while she thinks.
"I'm not sure I can hack into a computer."
"I'm not sure we have a choice," says Marjorie. "You see, it's either that or Stefan gives the information voluntarily. And that will involve a much more complex process."
"I'm never near his laptop, though."
"It may be best done at night. Invite him over to your flat. And then do it while he's sleeping." Marjorie has to go and walks off towards Tem's house, leaving Ella on the bench with her thoughts. She looks at her hands, which are shaking. She wants to run. She wants nothing to do with this. She feels alone and afraid, with no idea what to do. She has to think of something. Something that will get her out of this. Catherine lays awake as the dawn light rises, and her eyes trace the outline of the heavy, dark wood furniture around her. She slept badly as the kidnap and her escape rolled around inside her mind for most of the night. The couple who run the hotel were concerned when Catherine had told them about her violent boyfriend who'd hit her and cut her leg. She had told them that she took his car and just ran, needing to get away. They looked at her with sadness and compassion. They gave her food and put her into one of their hotel rooms. The couple had continued to look after her, feeding her and dressing her wound throughout the next day. In the evening, the three of them had sat around a log fire and talked about the winters they'd known. Catherine found herself talking about her real life, with all the names and towns changed, but real events and real memories. In the dawn, all seems calm now. She can feel her body relaxing, and she breathes out. Then out of the corner of her eye, she sees a shadow move. It's the merest movement, but it is there. She pulls back the duvet and rises to a standing position without a single noise. Catherine pulls on her jeans and boots, and she ties back her hair, her fingers moving deftly. The bread knife is under her pillow, and she pulls it out, the blade catching the light. She listens, but there's no sound as she moves across the room. Suddenly the peace is shattered by the sound of breaking glass. It seems to be an explosion. Before she knows it, the guy from the house is in the room. His shirt is stained red from his stomach wound, but now a bandage is wrapped around most of his chest, and a Caratel combat knife is in his hand. He lunges for her. She dodges and crashes into the side wall. He turns with speed and lunges again. She grabs his knife hand and pulls it back towards his own body, twisting him in the process. He is stronger than her and brings the blade near to Catherine's face. They both bring their strength to bear against the weapon, but his force moves it slowly towards her skin. He pushes her back onto the bed and falls with her. The knife comes up to her throat. Blood spills out from a nick in her skin. Then he brings his fist down on her head. Catherine had lost her grip of the bread knife as they fell onto the bed, and she pads her open hand across the fabric, trying to make contact again. His fist comes again. She can't stop the power. As the third punch is about to land, her fingers feel the plastic handle of the knife. They curl around it, and she lifts it as high as it will go, then down between his shoulder blades. His eyes stare back at her. Then the red trace of blood rises in his throat and out through his open mouth, spraying her face before he collapses down on top of her.